you're blind to something very clear to somebody who thinks differently than you think. So yeah. having that opposing viewpoint, having somebody that brings a skill set that's different from yours and is strong where you're weak, that's a key component to business and real estate in general.
This is the naked truth about real estate investing. Your host, Javier, has already been through all the brain damage of this business, so you don't have to go through it. That way, you're not exposed to all of the risk of losing your shirt or getting caught with your pants down. So let's dive into another No BS episode right now.
Hello, everybody. And today on the show, I have Mark McGuire. He is from Pennsylvania and he does self-storage. He's in his early 30s. He's married 4 years, got no kids, dual income, which is pretty cool. So he's put all his money in real estate. He's done like 12 or 13 syndications and GPs, LP, and different asset classes, multifamily, I think like hospitality, self-storage, industrial. So he's got a lot of expertise at the ripe age of early 30s, right? I think 32. Well, I might ask him, hopefully I don't forget, Mark. But, he's really focused on self-storage. We're going to talk self-storage, why self-storage is good for him, what's his sweet spot, where he gets his deals from, and a couple of things that he does that, to get people to rent his units. So let's not wait any longer and let's get Mark on the show. Mark, let us know what's up.
Awesome. Thanks for having me, Javier. This is great, man. It's been a blast so far talking before the show. So yeah, so I do self-storage. We flip self-storage facilities. I work with Hearthfire Capital and, we syndicate self-storage and give investors the ability to participate in the self-storage asset class on a fractional level without having to put up the entire 30-35% required to get in your own.
Cool. All right. That's short and sweet. How about personally? Married, kids?
Yeah, married. My beautiful wife, Leah. She is an ICU nurse. She reminds me daily that she's a healthcare hero. She also humbly reminds me that I am the least humble person she's ever met in her entire life. So thankfully, I'm an awesome wife to keep me grounded. No kids. And, we're loving it, man. We're double income, no kids. We're a bunch of dinks.
Oh, look at that, man. Yeah, for sure. I have 5 kids, man. So
how do you do it?
I don't know. It's just that my wife takes care of everything. So definitely. Good. And I had kids at one point. I had kids in at home, elementary school, middle school, high school, and college. That's how wide range of kids ages is insane. Anyways, but all right. So married, how long have you been married?
I've been married about 4.5 years, just over 4.5 years now.
Cool. 4.5 years. Well, congratulations. 4.5 years. Once you get over like the first two and the rest are easy. That's what I say.
That's what I'm hoping for. We definitely hit our heads on a couple of walls. That's for sure.
It's just like kids, man. Once you have 3, you can have 4 or 5. You can have 10. Don't matter. After 3, it doesn't matter anymore. All right. So, you invest in self-storage. I know you've done some other, you got a single family, you've done industrial. What other real estate have you done?
Yeah, I've had the opportunity to participate in a lot of different asset classes. And I started honestly in the single family space. I was exposed to residential and multifamily real estate at a very young age. I was very fortunate to have family who was invested in it. My grandfather was heavily invested in the multifamily space, still is. As we came out of the recession, I honestly actually didn't even know what my family had. I was growing up, my grandfather was the millionaire next door. He was the guy that drove around in the beater and, you never knew what he had. And he was proud of that. It's just a game to him. And the game is not, how can I show off what I have? It's how little can I spend to be happy? Like that's been his game, his entire life. So here's a guy, self-made, built it all himself. He is dad and his brother and came up from being super poor. And so I got exposed to the multifamily side, started to learn about debt a little bit, and then got exposed to the, these passive investing space with respect to syndication in like 2016, 2017. And once I got turned on to that, it was just kind of like my world opened up. And I couldn't believe you could get that type of a return with out all the effort. And
sure,
it's just been history from there.
Yeah. So you're part of 12, 13 syndications right now?
Yep. Yeah. I'm part of 13 syndications right now on the LP side. And I'm a sponsor on the GP side in 4.
Cool. Awesome. Now all these self-storage or a mixture?
Yeah. So on the LP side, it's a mixture. Sponsorship side, everything's with Hearthfire Capital. On the sponsorship, or excuse me, on the LP side, I'm in hospitality and like wedding venues. I'm in multifamily, I'm in industrial, and I'm in self-storage as well.
Awesome. Well, let me ask you this. Why self-storage?
So self-storage is a fascinating asset class because it's like industrial real estate where it's got similar characteristics, only it's consumer-facing instead of business-facing, and it's got rapid adaptability in pricing. So in an industrial lease, you're going to go to a smaller user base, right? You're going to have a user base that's, you know, depending on the size of the facility, 1, 2, 3, 4 users. And you're going to demise this space, meaning carve it up into smaller spaces, depending upon the needs of the end user. That's great because you're going to go and sign, 3, 4, 5 year leases. Maybe you get a little bit longer depending upon the credit rating of the tenant. But generally speaking, you're going to have 5 year leases. You're going to lock in at a price per square foot. And generally speaking, these leases are triple net. They didn't used to be. Now more and more people coming into the space are all triple net based, meaning the tenant absorbs the taxes, the insurances, and the maintenance for the building. So your gross rents essentially become your net income as the landlord. Other than that, self-storage gives you the ability to constantly change your price. So they're 30-day leases. You have a really large tenant base. So, you have lots of people coming and going. So you're constantly replenishing your tenant base. And you can kind of manage it all from behind a computer. As long as you have a good on-site manager. So love it for those reasons. And you can constantly just keep making micro tweaks to really push your NOI and your top line.
Yeah. So, all right, I'm writing all these questions down. Okay, great. Cool. So one of the key things you just said was you're able to 30-day leases, so you can kind of change with the market, right? So yeah, I know, I buy some warehouses and I know you locked a tenant in for 5, 3, 5, 7 years and you're doing 2 to 3%, rent bumps every year, triple net lease. So it's pretty much no headaches, right? You just check your account, make sure your money's in there every month, right? You're going to make less money most likely, but it's less work and it's only one lease to sign every 5 years, right? Mm-hmm. But in some markets out there, we've seen a 20, 30, 40% rent increase in 12 months, right? Mm-hmm. So if that happens in your market and you sign somebody up, at the beginning of 2021 for a 7-year lease, man, you're stuck there for 7 years and you can't, you can't get that 40%, 20% rent bumps that have been happening because the market's gone crazy. At the same time, the market kind of goes down, you're still stuck in those higher rents, but usually rents go up, right? They don't really go down. So
yeah, I mean, rents can go down, though. That's one thing. America's got amnesia right now. I mean, the economic climate, it's today's May 3rd, 2022. I think we're in a shift right now. I think we're in the recession has started. No one's talking about it, but people I know in the residential real estate space are starting to see lower price points really encounter some resistance. They're not seeing as much strength of activity and they're not seeing as many offers. They're not seeing as many showings. And a lot of the liquidity that's been created over the last 2 years, I think has burnt off because the reality of the increase in goods and services in from everyone's instituting price increases, gas, grocery stores, babysitters, your lawnmower, all these people who you've been paying to do something for the last couple of years, they all brought their prices up. So it's not there anymore.
Yeah. Even my 11-year-old's like, Dad, I need a bump on my inflations here, Dad. I can't get $20 on Saturday anymore, on Sunday. I need 20% more. I'm like, what?
Tell him he needs 20% more work.
And like, come on, $5 more anyways. Yeah. So even he wants to bump up his allowance every week. But yeah, that makes sense. So, for sure, you're right. We do see the economy slow down. I think we had back-to-back. Well, we're probably going to have back-to-back reports when the GDP comes out. And that'll be, we have two reports back-to-back, which is with no growth. You're basically in a recession, right? That's the beginning of a recession.
Yeah.
So yeah, everything's slowing down a little bit. I know in 2008, 2009, we had the real estate crash. How did self-storage do between 2008, 2009, 2010? How did that do?
Yeah. I almost don't want to tell you the truth because I don't want to give away my position here, but they did great. And not only did it do great in 08, 09, 10, when a lot of multifamily guys lost their shirts, especially the ones who over leveraged, self-storage did great during COVID too. They didn't see rent moratoriums. They didn't see, rent ceilings and eviction moratoriums. So the secret on self-storage is, has really gotten out and there's a lot of capital pouring in from other asset classes like office and retail that were once seen as the golden children of commercial real estate, that everything's triple net, always goes up, everything's great. as you have people running away from these spaces because you had tenant default and vacancy, and then your cap rates went from 6 and 5 to 8, self-storage is looking like Cinderella before midnight. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, no, for sure. I mean, self-storage has always been, it's been a pretty hot topic. A few things you can do with it. I'll let you talk about some few tips to increase your NOI, but can do some automation as well. So there's a few things you can do with self-storage, and it's pretty much not very labor intensive, right? It's not like you got to turn full remodels like on a multifamily. So tell me about kind of your guys' sweet spot. What are you guys looking for as far as self-storage? What size or square footage or markets?
You know, so it's interesting. So it really kind of depends on the structure, right? It depends on, you know, we syndicate. One of the things that we're starting to look at as well as, you know, some smaller opportunities that may not fit a syndication, but could be ripe and really lucrative for a JV structure. And so we are, you know, looking for facilities on the syndication side that are generally have site economics where it's 35, 40,000 square feet. You can do some light expansion, get to, you know, total square footage when it's all said and done around 50 to 60,000 square feet plus.
That would give you like what, like 300 units?
In that square footage, you're probably talking closer to 450-ish.
Okay.
450, I would say around. It really depends on your unit mix, and it depends on your average unit size, right? So when you're in more rural markets, you're going to have a larger average unit mix, meaning that your average unit size is going to be higher. So in a rural market, you know, like a tertiary market, you're going to be looking probably $130, $135 per square foot. Going into secondary markets, you're going to see that throttle back. Your average unit size is going to be closer to probably 110 to 120, 125. Once again, density dependent. And then as you get urban, which would be generally more primary markets, you're going to have smaller living spaces. You're going to see that drop anywhere from 90 to like 105, 110. So it really all depends. If you're in Midtown in Manhattan, you're going to have a 90 square foot unit size. It makes no sense to have 130 square foot unit size because the price per foot to build is way too high.
Yep.
So if you built on a spreadsheet, you do nothing but literally 5x5s because the rent per square foot that you can get on a 5x5 is the highest. The greater your size per square foot, the lower your rent per square foot on the total facility goes down. So it's like trying to maximize keeping that small size, but making sure that there's product market fit.
So you're syndicating these 30 to 40,000 square foot facilities, rentable square feet, and then you're gonna some room to expand to 50 to 60,000. Those are the ones that you're syndicating, correct? Mm-hmm.
Yep.
Okay.
Yep.
And if you do some syndications on those, and then you have some other ones you want to do a JV, what does that look like? You're looking like 75 to 125 units. I mean, was kind of still varies per market, or how do you structuring those, or kind of tell me about the JV?
Yeah. So JV, I mean, that's something we're actively working through right now. That model admittedly is not baked. So I can tell you, so the working thesis, although with a giant asterisk saying subject to change, generally we're looking, you know, 20,000 square feet, ability to add another 10,000 or so. So you're looking at, you know, total square footage, which is 20 to 30,000, because what happens is the big players, the larger private equity buyers and the REITs want 50 to 60,000 square feet in order for the site economics and the site size to make sense to acquire. So if you're not going to get there, you have to understand you're going to have to hold in perpetuity, which is more of the JV strategy, by the way. Or the person that you're selling it to, you're going to have to dial back your cap rate assumptions because that buyer is not going to pay a compressed cap rate because cost of capital for a smaller buyer is higher.
Sure.
So, you know, 20 to 30,000 square feet, which means that generally you're still secondary, tertiary space because you're not going to be able to get a 20,000 square foot facility in a primary MSA. You're just not. Like, someone will buy that, knock it over, and go up 5-6 stories up.
Yep.
That's what'll happen.
Yeah. Because it's already built, it's already a zone for self storage and they can build just as high as they can go. Yeah, for sure. That totally makes sense. So I'm a big proponent for the JV side. So I know you say yours is on the works. So I know we had a brief conversation before we started the podcast. You know, I did record that and it was actually pretty good. But look, I definitely like the JV model just because on the traditional syndication, most of the time you got to sell, right, to make those returns. Or, you know, maybe you could refinance and not get those returns, but you told some investors, hey, we're going to sell in 2 years or 3 years or 5 years. So some investors are expecting for you to sell and to get to make the returns, even though you can sometimes refinance and get the money back, or just hold it long-term, right? Just as a, like a partnership. But so just kind of tell me a few kind of like exit strategies you can have as far as a syndication, like what kind of other exit strategies you can have?
Yeah. So exit strategies are such a hot topic within our company right now, because our company, one thing that makes us truly unique is we're all investors first. And the truth about syndications that no one really talks about, so I'm going to expose the ugly truth of syndications here. It's a giant
real estate investing, naked truth.
There you go.
Go for it.
It's a giant like flywheel. You got to turn this giant crank. And the thing is the sponsors really don't get paid until like you sell. So until the exit, the vast majority of the work, you're working for free. Yep. And you know, what pays to keep the lights on are the acquisition fees and the disposition fees. And so if, unless you have new projects coming online, I'm sorry.
I said barely.
Yeah. And the funny part is everyone complains that the acquisition and disposition fees are so high. But sometimes I just want to be like, well, let me show you my overhead and let me show you what it takes to like have all this go on.
Correct.
So the challenge with exit strategies is that most syndicators want to sell because in the syndicator's best interest, because they get paid upon the sale. So one of the things that we're looking to do to give a competitive advantage with our projects is to really make this a tax efficient investing strategy and offer an exit strategy beyond a sale. So say we do sell, we want to give investors that participate with us the ability to 1031 forward into another project. So we want to provide opportunities on the other side of the project that they're currently in order to give them a vehicle to go into. Because everyone's biggest obstacle is like, well, if I sell, then what do I do with the money? We face that all the time with site owners. They don't want to sell because they're like, well, where else am I going to get this return? We have site owners that come and invest back with us. They'll basically sell us the facility and keep a slug of money back. And then we'll take them through this exact strategy. Yep. So that's done through a TIC agreement, tenant in common, ownership yep. structure. There just comes with some unique challenges in making sure that everybody in the vehicle wants the 1031. So you got to set the expectation up front.
For sure. So if you had to pick between, I know you haven't done a JV or it's in the works, but JV or syndication?
If you would have talked to me 6 months ago, I would have said syndication. If you would have talking to me today, I would say the JV gives you the ability to exit a job. So probably would run a parallel course. I mean, it's good to do both. I think there's a market for both. And at the same time, you know, from the sponsorship side, it's more advantageous on the JV. Yeah, you get paid a fairer a portion of all the work that you're doing.
Correct.
Transparently.
Yeah, for sure. Yes. Well, you and I were talking about that. So I do traditional syndications and I also do JV just because in the traditional syndication, it keeps the lights on, right? You get paid acquisition fee and you might have another sponsor, another GP you got to split that with. And you do have capital event or an exit fee and refinance or a sale. And then you do keep some money. But you know, if it takes 3 to 5 years, you're really not getting paid till the end. But with JV, you know, you can, you know, it's not about us making more money. It's just everybody makes more money, right? It's more of a relationship now. It's more like we're a joint venture, right? We're partners in this project. And we really want to try to keep this project because then you start building your net worth and you're able to 1031 it when it goes up in value and you're not forced necessarily to sell, you know, so the sponsors can make money, right? So it's very beneficial for both. So I think, yeah, you're in the right track doing both, doing a JV and a traditional syndication. So
yeah,
it's good for sure. Awesome. Cool. All right. So right now I know the self-storage market is hot. So what is your favorite deal flow? Is it brokers? You going off market or what are you guys doing?
Yeah. I mean, I'll put it to you this way. I don't think there's a market that's not hot other than maybe office, but even that seems like it's getting steam here. So our way that we've sourced a lot of our deals has been through broker relationships. So one thing that's been great, you know, we've built strong relationships in the industry. So we've been able to get swings at properties prior to them going on market. So, you know, we're not paying the off market, no broker involved price, but we're not paying the stupid 8 bidders, way too much money price. That being said, you know, one of our biggest focuses lately has been trying to stand up that off market operation. The challenge with self storage is you just have, everyone says there's mom and pop ownership. And the truth is, yes, there is. It is fragmented where you don't have large institutional ownership. But truthfully, these people are all getting hit by brokers. You know, there's just less I think there's like 50,000 storage facilities in the country. I mean, if you were to look at how many multi-unit or multi-family properties there are, I don't know what the number is, but I'm sure it's significantly more.
I used to know those numbers, but yeah, I forgot.
Maybe, good for maybe you.
I'll study it up, but I forgot. I used to know the numbers between unit, like how many below 100, how many above 100, and it was a whole bunch.
Well, so you have to try to figure out where are people not playing. So that's part of the game with the JV strategy is like, I think the real opportunity in self-storage is sub 40,000 square feet. I was talking to another guy in the industry, been in the industry for 15 years, and he was like, the real opportunity here in self-storage is 20 to 40,000 square feet because the site economics won't attract the attention of the bigger buyers who are playing in the lower capital pool.
Well, you're trying to see some big buyers buying 150 units, 120 units apartment buildings. Like, holy crap. Like, I thought it was, they were above 200, 250. Yeah, some big buyers now coming a little bit lower just because they can't find anything.
Well, the bigger buyers are also moving further away from MSAs. They're moving secondary, and I'll speak for self-storage. I can't speak for other asset classes because frankly, I don't know, but in self-storage, you have people moving out of the top MSAs and going further, going to the second tier, in some cases to the third tier, because of all of the migration that's gone on within the last 2 years due to, you know, telecommute options with COVID.
Yeah, for sure. Cool. So we got your sweet spot. We got the deal flow. Talk to me a little bit about automation and like, what can you do to increase your NOI? Like, just give me a couple of tips.
Yeah, this has been a particularly hot topic in storage. So everyone's talking about going unmanned. That's the term. And I think unmanned is great in theory, but until you can get a robot that can drive to your facility, get out of the vehicle, break out a broom, open a lock and sweep the unit, you're never going to get away from a human being involved. You're just not. So I think the unmanned idea is a farce, unless you got a warehouse and, you know, you got some universal crazy Bluetooth key, but then even still, there's only so much product that could fit that mold, right? Yeah. So everyone's looking at ways to reduce the human component and reduce the, I would say like the Sudoku time where people are sitting there doing Sudoku puzzles in the office, watching Mari and like terrible daytime TV, waiting for the next guy to walk in the door. Every facility owner is looking how to cut that out. That's an efficiency there. But a lot of the ways that we're driving NOI has to do with doing facility upgrades that allow for access, after hour access, remote gate capabilities. One of the things we've explored is the Bluetooth locking technology hasn't made sense in our markets that we've been in relative to the cost to install that. And truthfully, security. One of the biggest things, the biggest user of self-storage by generation is millennials. And of the millennial generation, 60% are women. So they place a lot of stock in the appearance and the curb appeal. So if your landscaping looks like hell, you're not going to get them. If they feel like the fencing looks all jacked up and the facility looks janky, they're going to go drive down the road to the next facility because they want to feel safe going to the facility, especially if it's at night.
Yeah, definitely makes sense. One of the guys in my mastermind does sell storage, and what he does, he'll buy like 75 units, 225 units, just 15,000, 20,000 square feet. And then when he has his landscaper go mow the grass, he'll give them a list right before they go out, like, hey, can you lock on unit 4, unit 28, and that, and then he'll have them sweep it, and he'll pay him whatever amount he pays him. So he's like, that's my guy. And he goes out there, you know, every 10 days, he's out there every 2 weeks. So he'll cut my locks and sweep my thing. So it kind of worked out for him. Like that's a smart idea. So, and the guy cutting the grass is happy because he makes more money by cutting those locks and sweeping those units. And he does, you know, he's like, you don't have no units for me to cut locks on. Cause kind of disappointed because he doesn't want to go cut the grass, right? Mow the lawn. So anyways, so that's one of the things that he does. So I thought that was pretty, pretty interesting. If you can find yourself a lawn care guy that can do it.
There's a lot of stories like that in self-storage where you just get that handyman who's just happy as the day is long, just being busy. That story is super common in the industry.
For sure. That's awesome. Well, Mark, I'm going to ask you, what has been the biggest mistake that you've made in real estate? What would you say it is? And how could you have avoided it?
And the biggest mistake I've made in real estate, I've been lucky. I've been in real estate for the last 10 years. Even all the mistakes I've made have kind of smoothed themselves out here.
Or if you could have done something different, what would you have done?
I would say the biggest mistakes I've made I'll expand it to maybe business.
Okay.
Is partnerships and choosing the right partner, choosing people who don't share your skill set, but bring a skill set that you struggle with. And I think a lot of people make the mistake of choosing a partner who is like them because that's comfortable and familiar. So you're like, oh yeah, they have the same outlook I do. They have the same thought process I do, but you really need to choose a partner. And actually, I guess this goes for real estate too. Having the right partner that brings a skill set that you don't and a lens that you don't, because sometimes you get this confirmation bias where if they think like you think, you're seeing it from the same vantage point, you're blind to something that would be very clear to somebody who thinks differently than you think. So yeah, having that opposing viewpoint, having somebody that brings a skill set that's different from yours, but yet complements yours and is strong where you're weak, that's a key component to business and real estate in general.
You know, I get that a lot, you know, partnerships, right? It's very important. So, you know, everybody do your due diligence on your partners and make sure that, of course, right, they bring something different than you bring to the table. And when it's 1+1=3, right? Or 1+1=4. 1+1=2, well, you got to like make sure that it's you guys connecting where you can almost, you know, have 50% more output, right, together, or 100% more output together. So very interesting because we do get that a lot. So appreciate that. Partnership's definitely a key. Mark, so how can somebody get a hold of you? I know we got Investing with Mark at Instagram, and I just followed you right now. All right.
Beautiful.
And so you have another follower. Where else? Tell us your website. Everything will be on the show notes as well. We'll give us some more contact places for you.
Yeah. Best way to reach me is investingwithmark.com. That's, you know, has contact, right? That takes you right to our HFR Capital website. Best way, I'll just go right there for the contact form, fill it out. We'll set up a time to talk.
Super cool. All right. So I'm to the best part of the show. We're going to take the next few minutes before we end the call. And I'm going to bring out my Naked Truth Roulette.
Ooh.
And then we're going to ask Mark three random questions. Got nothing to do with real estate, man. Just three random questions.
Beautiful.
And hopefully he gets some good questions, some layup questions here so he can stay married for another 4.5 years. All right. All right, let's go. Here we go. Here is the Naked Truth Roulette. Let's spin it. All right. First question. Let's see what we got. What is your most used curse word? Put it that way.
Fuck.
Okay. That's a good one. Yeah. I use that one all the time. And my wife, you know, I've been married 24 years. I've been with my wife, I don't know, 27 years. And I think the worst thing that ever come out of her mouth was the word ass. That's because she called me an ass. And that's like the worst thing she ever said. Anyways. So even the kids looked over like, did mom just say ass? Yeah, she did. And she's never cursed. And I curse all the time. So she's good. So that's definitely my favorite curse word, by the way.
I'm a king of efficiency, man. Lots of uses and it's short. And tonality can really convey the true utility of the word.
Exactly. For sure. It can mean a lot of different things. All right. Second question for Mark. All right. What is your favorite food?
Sushi.
Sushi. What kind? You like raw sushi or fried or tempura? What do you like?
I like all sorts of sushi, but the fish quality has to be really good.
Yes, I was about to
say. I was spoiled with an incredible sushi restaurant that you wouldn't even know it was there. And it's like 5 minutes from my house. And my wife and I go there. I think we keep that place in business sometimes.
Oh, that's cool. Mark, I didn't even ask where you lived.
I live right outside of Philly in Montgomery County, Pennsylvania.
Outside of Philly, I always tell the story. Philly, I always think about Lancaster, Pennsylvania.
That's where our facilities are, yeah.
Oh, really? Yeah, I was there. That was my first time ever to Philly. It was Amish country, and it was a very unique experience. And it was beautiful, by the way.
Well, I'll tell you, Philly and Lancaster are very different from a culture.
Oh, for sure.
You fly into the Philly airport, that is one place. You get out to Lancaster, it is a whole other speed. Yeah,
it was like two different worlds, I can tell you that, man. It was very shocking to me, but I enjoyed totally Philly, and I enjoyed Lancaster, for sure. All right, cool. Last question for Mark. Let's see, we get a controversial question in here. Possibly not, but let's see where we're at. Nope. Okay. How do you feel about putting pineapple on your pizza?
I mean, I like pineapple. I like, it's not my go-to, but I will eat it.
We'll eat with pineapple. All right, cool. Awesome.
Better have ham on it though. I mean, if you're going to have pineapple, you can't be pineapple alone. That's just too weird.
There we go. Well, Mark, appreciate you getting on the show and on jumping on the roulette and surviving the Naked Truth Roulette. All right. So again, thanks, Mark, for being on the show. It was a pleasure. Very nice to meet you. And I'm sure I'll see you around at some events. Anything that I left out, anything you want to add before end the show?
It was great. I really enjoyed it. Thanks for bringing the heat today.
Appreciate it. Thanks, Mark. This is Javier Hinojo, your host of The Naked Truth, Real Estate Investing. Don't lose your shirt. Just as promised, I like to give out free stuff, some tools and tips that's actually helped me in my business. There's nothing out there like getting some free stuff that people have spent a lot of time, energy in putting together. It's like a referral. Somebody asked me for an electrician. You don't know what kind of brain damage I had to go through to give you this good referral for an electrician. You got to appreciate referrals from people, okay? Because they went through a lot to find that one good person. So I'm going to give you my due diligence template for buying apartment buildings. It's attached to monday.com. It is an affiliate link, so they're going to send me a kickback. Not a lot, but a little bit. But you can either download it as an Excel, or you can put it on monday.com. Monday.com is pretty cool because it's a project management platform software. It's super cool. I use it all the time for my social media, for my team, tracking deals, doing tasks for everybody. It's actually pretty good. You can track construction. It's a project management platform. It's really cool. Monday, like the day, monday.com. So my due diligence checklist is there for free for you.
This has been The Naked Truth. Our mission is to give it to you raw. If you got value from this episode, you're invited to leave an honest written review and share this episode with a friend. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you on the next episode.